Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
May 30, 1593. A small, dimly lit room in Deptford, England. Four men sit at a table inside a private lodging house. The air is thick with tension. Christopher Marlowe, England's most brilliant playwright, is among them. He's only 29, but he's already reshaped the English stage. His words razor sharp, his influence undeniable. Yet, there's something off tonight. This isn't a friendly gathering. Just days before, he had been arrested, accused of heresy and atheism, crimes punishable by death. He was released under mysterious circumstances, but his days were numbered. He knew too much. He had worked as an intelligence agent, a pawn in the ruthless political games of the crown. If he talked, he could expose secrets that could shake the kingdom to its core. What happens next is supposedly a matter of public record. An argument erupts over a bill, an unpaid tab. Voices rise, chairs scrape against wooden floors, and then violence. A dagger is drawn. There's a struggle, and then a single thrust. The blade plunges straight into Marlowe's right eye. He collapses, dead. His body is rushed away, buried in an unmarked grave. Case closed. At least, that's what the story they wanted everyone to believe. But here's the problem. Nothing about that night adds up. The coroner's report is riddled with inconsistencies. The details of the fight are vague, conflicting, almost scripted. And why was Marlowe's body buried so quickly, without ceremony, without anyone verifying its identity? Then there's the man who supposedly killed him. He was arrested, but released almost immediately. Not only was he pardoned, but he remained in royal service, working directly under the Queen's own advisor. But the most chilling part? Less than 2 weeks after Marlowe's so-called death, something strange happens. A new literary voice emerges. One that sounds eerily familiar. A name appears on the cover of Venus and Adonis, a poetic work dripping with the same linguistic mastery, the same intricate wordplay, the same signature style that Marlowe was known for. The name? William Shakespeare. Marlowe had vanished, and in his place, Shakespeare had been born. Christopher Marlowe wasn't just a playwright. He was a force of nature. His words didn't dance, they detonated. His plays, Dr. Faustus, Tamburlaine, The Jew of Malta, weren't entertainment. They were weapons. Weapons against authority, against religion, against the very idea that a man should stay in his place. He wrote like a man possessed because, in many ways, he was. Marlowe wasn't just a writer. He was a scholar, a linguist, a philosopher. He spoke Latin, Greek, and Italian fluently. He was educated at Cambridge, but wasn't just some bookish academic. He had an edge, a dangerous one. Because Marlowe wasn't just a playwright, he was a spy. His connections ran deep into the veins of Queen Elizabeth's intelligence network, rubbing shoulders with men whose loyalty was measured in blood. He fed information to the crown, infiltrated Catholic circles, and danced with death more times than anyone knew. He was reckless, untouchable, until suddenly he wasn't. May 1593, London was on fire, not in the literal sense, but something worse, paranoia. The city was drowning in fear of Catholic conspiracies, foreign spies, and heretics lurking in the shadows. And at the center of it all, a certain piece of paper, a heretical manifesto, had surfaced, a document mocking the church, dripping with blasphemy, a death sentence in ink. And it was signed Tamburlaine, the name of Marlowe's most infamous character. That was all the authorities needed. Days later, Marlowe was arrested, but not in chains, no. He was taken into protective custody. A private hearing, no records, no official charges, just a quiet conversation behind closed doors. And then he was released. That never happened. No one accused of atheism or heresy was released. You were either executed or you were silenced. But Marlowe walked free for a moment. 5 days later, he was summoned to Deptford, a private meeting at a lodging house. Three men were waiting for him, three men who knew how to make someone disappear. The air inside the room was thick, pipe smoke, sweat, something else. Marlowe sat across from the three men. They weren't his friends, he knew that. Ingram Fraser, a known con artist, Nicholas Skerries, a money launderer, Robert Polley, an intelligence officer with a history of cleaning things up. It wasn't a friendly gathering. Marlowe poured himself a drink, but he barely touched it. His fingers tapped restlessly against the wooden table. They talked about money, about debts, about the queen, small talk. But the real conversation was happening in glances, in the shifting weight of bodies, in the tension humming beneath the words. Then, movement. A chair scraped, a hand reached for something beneath a coat, and in a flash, Marlowe saw it, the glint of a blade. The fight was brutal, fast, a blur of fists, bodies slamming into furniture, a table overturned. The dagger was out, a struggle. Then, pain. A sharp, blinding pain as steel punctured flesh, but not in the eye. That's the lie history tells you. The fatal wound, the dagger through the right eye, was a convenient detail. Neat. Too neat. Because what happened next didn't fit the story. The door burst open. Footsteps, voices shouting, and then silence. The three men stood over Marlowe's body, but he wasn't dead, not yet. An hour later, a body was buried in an unmarked grave, quickly, quietly, no family, no friends, no formal identification. A rush job, a cover-up. Because the men who had been carried out of that room wasn't Marlowe. And yet, within days of that night, something else happened. A new literary voice emerged. A name that had never written a single play before. A name that sounded eerily familiar. William Shakespeare. Christopher Marlowe was gone. And in his place, the greatest writer in history had just been born. Or was he? London, 1593. The air is thick with unease. The city is on edge. Plague ravages the streets. Religious tensions flare, and spies lurk in the shadows. Christopher Marlowe has been dead for mere weeks, and the theater world should be in mourning. His talent was unmatched, his influence undeniable. Yet, No grand tributes are made, no poetic laments from fellow writers. Instead, something else happens. A new voice emerges. It starts quietly, a whisper among the literary. A new poem is making the rounds, Venus and Adonis. The work is bold, elegant, unmistakably Marlowian in style. But the name on the cover? A total unknown, William Shakespeare. This name had never been attached to anything of literary significance. No history of writing, no record of schooling beyond the basic education, no formal training in poetry or playwriting. And yet, suddenly, he appears out of nowhere, wielding an impossibly refined grasp of language, myth, and classical literature. Theaters, which should have been mourning the loss of Marlowe, instead have a new sensation on their hands. The works attributed to this Shakespeare guy seem eerily familiar. The cadence, the rhythm, the sheer force of the words. It's as if Marlowe never left. Because maybe he didn't. Marlowe wasn't just a writer. He was a problem. He had enemies in high places. He was dangerous because he was brilliant. And he was reckless because he thought he was untouchable. Then, in May 1593, the hammer dropped. A warrant was issued for his arrest. Atheism, blasphemy, heresy. Crimes that didn't just get you hanged, they got you erased. His friend Thomas Kyde had already been dragged in, tortured, forced to give up names. Marlowe's own words, his philosophies, his beliefs had become his death sentence. He had one option, to disappear. But how? A public execution would be too risky. The Queen's court couldn't be seen condemning a man so closely tied to intelligence work. There had to be another way. A staged murder. A quick burial. A few forged documents. Then, silence. And suddenly, a new writer emerges. One with no history, no past, no reason to possess the exact literary genius of the man who had just died. But if Marlowe was alive, where did he go? And more importantly, if Marlowe was alive, who the hell was Shakespeare? The ink on Venus and Adonis was barely dry before something else happened. A flood of new plays hit the London stage. Henry VI, Titus Andronicus, Richard III, plays filled with the kind of linguistic firepower that only one man had ever mastered. Plays bursting with Marlowe's signatures. His themes, power, ambition, fate. But the name at the top of the page, William Shakespeare. Within months of Marlowe's death, his words didn't just survive, they took over. Because Christopher Marlowe didn't die in Deptford. He was just getting started. If Christopher Marlowe had truly died in that Deptford lodging house in 1593, then what happened next should have been impossible. Instead of fading into history as a brilliant but doomed playwright, something far stranger occurred. His words refused to die. A literary phantom began weaving itself into the fabric of English theater, as if Marlowe's pen had never stopped moving. The same bold themes, the same masterful use of blank verse, the same audacity of storytelling, but now under a different name, William Shakespeare. The Marlowian theory suggests that Marlowe, facing imminent execution, was smuggled out of England. To where? Italy, perhaps, where many of Shakespeare's plays just happened to be set. A coincidence or a breadcrumb trail? Because here's the thing. Shakespeare, the so-called bard, should not have known what he knew. Before Marlowe's death, William Shakespeare was a nobody, a commoner from Stratford with no record of higher education, no extensive travels, no formal legal or political training. And yet, suddenly this man, this Glover's son, was penning plays dripping with knowledge of the Italian aristocracy, continental politics, legal doctrines, and classical literature that could only have come from someone extensively trained in these subjects. Marlowe had that training. Shakespeare? Nothing. And yet, from 1594 to 1597, the years immediately following Marlowe's disappearance, Shakespeare's works explode onto the London stage. And what do these plays sound like? Marlowe. The same cadence, the same rhythm, the same linguistic fingerprints. Even stranger, some of Shakespeare's phrases appear lifted straight from Marlowe's earlier works, as if the same mind was recycling and refining old ideas. Was this just influence, or was it something more? For those who know where to look, the Shakespearean plays contain clues, tiny breadcrumbs left behind, like a ghost teasing at its presence. In As You Like It, the phrase "dead shepherd" appears, an unusual phrase. Except for one detail, Marlowe had long been known as the Shepherd of Poets. A morbid joke or a signature? In Love's Labour's Lost, there is a reference to Navarre, one of the very places Marlowe was rumored to have fled after his stage death. And then there's the first folio, published in 1623, the collection of Shakespeare's plays. But this book isn't just a literary masterpiece, it's a mess. Spelling errors, inconsistencies in authorship, stylistic shifts between plays that make no sense for a single writer. Some scholars argue this is because the plays weren't written by one person, or worse, they weren't supposed to be published at all. Because maybe the first folio wasn't a celebration of Shakespeare. Maybe it was a cover-up, a final attempt to seal Marlowe's words under the wrong name forever.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I got here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words "Jesus saves" written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, let's play a little game, a challenge, if you will. I'm going to show you a line from one of the greatest works in the English language, and I want you to guess who wrote it, Marlowe or Shakespeare. Trust your gut, because what you're about to see might just change the way you look at history forever.
I am enamored of my own misfortune.
A brooding, introspective lament about fate and suffering. Sounds like Shakespeare, right? That deep, tragic self-awareness. Well, it's not. This line belongs to Marlowe, but don't worry, that was just a warm-up.
There is no darkness but ignorance.
A sharp, philosophical statement. Clean, timeless, pure Shakespeare, right? This one was Shakespeare. But hold on to that thought, we're just getting started.
Accursed be he that first invented war.
A curse against violence, dripping with righteous fury. Sounds like something straight out of Shakespeare's Henry V before battle, doesn't it? But again, it's Marlowe. Almost as if Shakespeare wasn't the only one writing these kinds of lines.
Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
Ah, now this one you know. The famous call to chaos. The fury before the storm. This has to be Shakespeare, doesn't it? And it is. But here's the thing. This doesn't exist in a vacuum. Just 4 years earlier, Marlowe was writing the same kind of battle cries, the same grand poetic curses on war. And no one blinked when Shakespeare suddenly perfected it.
Thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire.
Suffering, the weight of fate, the eternal punishment of a man lost in his own despair. Shakespeare at his finest, right? Now compare it to this.
Why, this is hell, nor am I out of it.
Same agony, same existential torment. But this one? Written by a man who supposedly died before King Lear was even a thought. Let's do just one more.
Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships?
You've heard this before. One of the most famous lines in all of English literature. Surely this has to be Shakespeare. But it's not. This line, so embedded in our cultural memory, isn't Shakespeare at all. It belongs to a man who, according to history, was already dead. So if Marlowe was already writing lines fit for Shakespeare's legacy, why would the world need Shakespeare at all? The Marlowian theory has been dismissed as nothing more than a literary conspiracy, a game for eccentric academics and overzealous researchers. Critics scoff, wave their hands, and say, there's no proof Marlowe survived. And that's the argument. Not that Shakespeare was undeniably the writer. Not that Marlowe couldn't have pulled it off. Just that there's no hard proof. But let's look at their so-called evidence. They claim Shakespeare's name is on the plays. Well, no kidding. If the deception was planned at the highest levels, do you really think they leave Marlowe's name on them? That's like expecting a spy to sign his real name on a forged passport. They argue that Shakespeare's writing evolved beyond Marlowe's influence. Okay, fine. But what if the real reason for that evolution was just time? Marlowe wasn't a stagnant writer. If he was alive, writing in secret, of course his style would shift. Of course it would deepen. He wasn't copying Marlowe. He was Marlowe. And the biggest one? The dagger they always reach for is that there are no official records of Marlowe after 1593. But let's think about that for a second. If the entire point was to erase him, why would there be? Let's set aside theories for a moment and just focus on cold, hard facts. Fact: before 1593, Shakespeare was nobody. No documented literary experience, no formal education beyond grammar school, no evidence that he had ever left England or studied foreign courts. Yet his works were drenched in legal, philosophical, and cultural expertise. Fact: the very year Marlowe dies, Shakespeare bursts onto the scene, fully formed, already a master of the craft. Fact: the earliest Shakespeare works are practically indistinguishable from Marlowe's. In fact, Marlowe had every reason to disappear. He was a target. He was dangerous. He was too valuable to kill outright. Yet the skeptics look at all this and say, nope, just a coincidence. And the most damning part? Even after all the arguments, all the so-called debunking, there's one thing the critics can't explain. Not a single letter, not a single manuscript, not a single personal document from Shakespeare's own hand proving he ever wrote anything. Christopher Marlowe, the playwright, vanished. William Shakespeare, the playwright, appeared. And the world never questioned it until now. For over 400 years, William Shakespeare has been celebrated as the greatest writer in the English language. The Bard of Avon, the genius, the unparalleled master of storytelling. His works are taught in every major university, performed in every major theater, and quoted by people who have no idea they're quoting Shakespeare. His plays, Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, are revered as the pinnacle of dramatic writing. His sonnets are held up as the gold standard of poetic expression. Entire academic fields exist solely to analyze his works. And yet, the very things that made him great, the explosive use of blank verse, the political intrigue, the philosophical depth, just happen to mirror the exact qualities of Christopher Marlowe's writing. His linguistic fingerprints are all over Shakespeare's works. His themes, his obsessions, his very soul somehow carried on under a different name. And for centuries, no one questioned it. Instead, scholars built libraries in Shakespeare's honor. Monuments were erected. His birthplace in Stratford became a shrine. Meanwhile, Christopher Marlowe, the man whose words may have actually shaped history, was buried in an unmarked grave, forgotten. And the greatest irony? If Marlowe truly was the man behind the curtain, then the most famous name in literature belongs to a dead man. By now, I think you know where I stand. But my goal here isn't to convince you. It never was. My goal is to tell the story, to lay out the facts as I see them, and let you decide for yourself. Because in the end, that's what history is. Not just a collection of names and dates, but a puzzle, one where the missing pieces are often more revealing than the ones we're given. So ask yourself, if everything we know about the greatest literary figure in history was built on a deception, what else have we blindly accepted? For centuries, entire institutions have been built on the works of a man who may have never written a single word. Academic careers, literary movements, the very foundation of English literature itself, anchored to a name that may have been nothing more than a mask. Meanwhile, Christopher Marlowe, perhaps the true mind behind it all, was erased, reduced to a footnote, a tragic prodigy cut down too soon. His brilliance stripped away, his legacy handed to another. This isn't just about Shakespeare. This is about history itself. How easy it is to rewrite. How simple it is to bury a man and replace him with an illusion. And how quickly we forget. But if Marlowe truly was the mind behind the curtain, if he was forced to watch his words claimed by another while he lived in exile, unrecognized and unheard, perhaps we owe him something. Not justice, because history rarely offers that, but recognition. So, for the man who may have given us the greatest words ever written, words that the world would never truly know were his, perhaps it's only fitting to give him the last.
O hollow name, thou thief of voice and verse, dost wear my words like stolen blood-wrought gold, yet time, that leprous rogue, shall lift the curse and truth unshroud the bones long left untold. Though kings may kneel to ghosts that wear my face, the quill shall whisper whom the world betrayed.
The irony? If Marlowe was the true writer behind Shakespeare's works, then even this verse belongs to him. And if that's true, then William Shakespeare never existed. Not as a playwright, not as a poet, not as a legend. Just a name, a lie. A shadow cast by a man the world was never supposed to remember. All right, folks, you made it to the end. I'm Ralph, and this has been another crazy ride on Divergent Files. And here's the deal, folks. You're not just an audience. You're the lifeblood of this channel. Your curiosity, your wild theories, your random comments, they're what keep this thing alive. So here's the takeaway. The world is weird, the stories are weirder, and we're just trying to make sense of it all. Thank you for sticking with us, for showing up, and for being part of this wild experiment. Until next time, stay curious, stay kind, and remember, you are truly appreciated.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts. Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.